pay them. The words were out. Better not to name the devil. Eddie winced. What little color remained in his face now left it. Eddie, are you all right?
No, Eddie said. I am most certainly not all right. But I'm not going to faint like a girl at an Andy Gibb concert either. What are we going to do?
For the time being, nothing. We have too many other things to do.
Don't we just? Eddie said. Over here, the wolves come in 24 days, if I've got it figured right. Over there in New York, who knows what day it is, the 6th of June, the 10th? Closer to July 15th than it was yesterday, that's for sure. But Roland, if what she's got inside her isn't human, we can't be sure her pregnancy will go 9 months. She might pop it in 6. Hell, she might pop it tomorrow.
Roland nodded and waited. Eddie had gotten this far. Surely he would make it the rest of the way. And he did.
We're stuck, aren't we?
Yes. We can watch her. But there's not much else we can do. We can't even keep her still in hopes of slowing things down, because she'd very likely guess why we were doing it. And we need her to shoot when the time comes. But before that, we'll have to train some of these people with whatever weapons they feel comfortable with. It'll probably turn out to be bows. Roland grimaced. In the end, he had hit the target in the north field with enough arrows to satisfy Court, but he had never cared for bow and arrow or bar and bolt. Those had been Jamie de Curry's choice of weapons, not his own.
We're really going to go for it, aren't we?
Oh, yes. And Eddie smiled. Smiled in spite of himself. He was what he was. Roland saw it and was glad. 6. As they walked back to Callahan's rectory house, Eddie asked,
You came clean with me, Roland. Why not come clean with her?
I'm not sure I understand you.
Oh, I think you do, Eddie said.
All right, but you won't like the answer.
I've heard all sorts of answers from you, and I couldn't say I've cared for much more than 1 in 5,
Eddie considered.
Nah, that's too generous. Make it 1 in 50.
The one who calls herself Mia, which means mother in the high speech, kens she's carrying a child. Although I doubt she kens what kind of a child. Eddie considered this in silence. Whatever it is, Mia thinks of it as her baby, and she'll protect it to the limit of her strength and life. If that means taking over Susanna's body, the way Detta Walker sometimes took over Odetta Holmes, she'll do it if she can.
And probably she could, Eddie said gloomily.
Then he turned directly to Roland.
So what I think you're saying, correct me if I've got it wrong, is that you don't want to tell Suze she might be growing a monster in her belly, because it might impair her efficiency.
Roland could have quibbled about the harshness of this judgment, but chose not to. Essentially, Eddie was right. As always when he was angry, Eddie's street accent became more pronounced. It was almost as though he were speaking through his nose instead of his mouth.
And if anything changes over the next month or so, if she goes into labor and pops out the creature from the Black Lagoon, for instance, she's going to be completely unprepared, won't have a clue.
Roland stopped about 20 feet from the rectory house. Inside the window, he could see Callahan talking to a couple of young people, a boy and a girl. Even from here, he could see they were twins.
Roland?
You say true, Eddie. Is there a point? If so, I hope you'll get to it. Time is no longer just a face on the water. As you yourself pointed out, it's become a precious commodity. Again, he expected a patented Eddie Dean outburst, complete with phrases such as kiss my ass or eat shit and die. Again, no such outburst came. And he was looking at him, that was all. Steadily and a little sorrowfully. Sorry for Susanna, of course, but also for the two of them. The two of them standing here and conspiring against one of the Tet.
I'm going to go along with you, Eddie said, but not because you're the Din, and not because one of those two is apt to come back brainless from Thunderclap.
He pointed to the pair of kids the old fellow was talking to in his living room.
I'd trade every kid in this town for the one Suze is carrying. If it was a kid. My kid.
I know you would, Roland said.
It's the Rose I care about, Eddie said. That's the only thing worth risking her for. But even so, you've got to promise me that if things go wrong, if she goes into labor, or if this Mia chick starts taking over, we'll try to save her.
I would always try to save her, Roland said, and then had a brief nightmare image, brief but very clear, of Jake dangling over the drop under the mountains.
You swear that? Eddie asked.
Yes, Roland said. His eyes met those of the younger man. In his mind, however, he saw Jake falling into the abyss.
7. They reached the rectory door just as Callahan was ushering the two young people out. They were, Roland thought, very likely the most gorgeous children he had ever seen. Their hair was black as coal, the boys' shoulder length, the girls bound by a white ribbon and falling all the way to her bottom. Their eyes were dark, perfect blue. Their skin was creamy pale, their lips a startling, sensuous red. There were faint spatters of freckles on their cheeks. So far as Roland could tell, the spatters were also identical. They looked from him to Eddie and then back to Susanna, who leaned in the kitchen doorway with a dish wiper in one hand and a coffee cup in the other. Their shared expression was one of curious wonder. He saw caution in their faces, but no fear.
"Roland, Eddie, I'd like you to meet the Tavery twins, Frank and Francine. Rosalita fetched them. The Taverys live not half a mile away, do you? You'll have your map by this afternoon, and I doubt if you'll ever have seen a finer one in all your life. It's but one of the talents they have."
The Tavery twins made their manners, Frank with a bow, and Francine with a curtsy. "You do us well, and we say thank you," Roland told them. An identical blush suffused their astoundingly creamy complexions. They muttered their thanks and prepared to slip away. Before they could, Roland put an arm around each narrow but well-made pair of shoulders and led the twins a little way down the walk. He was taken less by their perfect child's beauty than by the piercing intelligence he saw in their blue eyes. He had no doubt they would make his map. He also had no doubt that Callahan had had Rosalita fetch them as a kind of object lesson, were one still needed. With no interference, one of these beautiful children would be a grizzling idiot a month from now.
"Sigh?" Frank asked. Now there was a touch of worry in his voice.
"Fear me not," Roland said, "but hear me well."
8. Callahan and Eddie watched Roland walk the Tavery twins slowly along the rectory's flagstoned path and toward the dirt drive. Both men shared the same thought. Roland looked like a benevolent grand père. Susanna joined them, watched, then plucked Eddie's shirt.
"Come with me a minute."
He followed her into the kitchen. Rosalita was gone, and they had it to themselves. Susanna's brown eyes were enormous, shining.
"What is it?" he asked her. "Pick me up."
He did.
"Now kiss me quick while you have the chance."
"Is that all you want?"
"Isn't it enough? It better be, Mr. Dean."
He kissed her, and willingly, but couldn't help marking how much larger her breasts were as they pressed against him. When he drew his face away from hers, he found himself looking for traces of the other one in her face, the one who called herself mother in the high speech. He saw only Susanna, but he supposed that from now on he would be condemned to look. And his eyes kept trying to go to her belly. He tried to keep them away, but it was as if they were weighted. He wondered how much that was between them would change now. It was not a pleasant speculation.
"Is that better?"
he asked.
"Much." She smiled a little, and then the smile faded.
"Eddie, is something wrong?"
He grinned and kissed her again. "You mean other than that we're all probably going to die here? Nope, nothing at all."
Had he lied to her before? He couldn't remember, but he didn't think so. And even if he had, he had never done so with such baldness, with such calculation. This was bad. 9. 10 minutes later, rearmed with fresh mugs of coffee and a bowl of pokeberries, they went out into the rectory's small backyard. The gunslinger lifted his face into the sun for a moment, relishing its weight and heat. Then he turned to Callahan.
"We three would hear your story now, Pear, if you'd tell it. And then mayhap stroll up to your church and see what's there."
"I want you to take it," Callahan said. "It hasn't desecrated the church. How could it when Our Lady was never consecrated to begin with? But it's changed it for the worse. Even when the church was still a building, I felt the Spirit of God inside it. No more. That thing has driven it out. I want you to take it."
Roland opened his mouth to say something noncommittal, but Susanna spoke before he could.
"Roland, you all right?"
He turned to her.
"Why, yes. Why would I not be?"
"You keep rubbing your hip."
Had he been? Yes, he saw. He had. The pain was creeping back already, in spite of the warm sun, in spite of Rosalita's cat oil. The dry twist.
"It's nothing," he told her, "just a touch of the rheumatiz." She looked at him doubtfully, then seemed to accept. "This is a hell of a way to start," Roland thought, "with at least two of us keeping secrets. We can't go on so, not for long." He turned to Callahan. "Tell us your tale. How you came by your scars, how you came here, and how you came by Black 13. We would hear every word." "Yes," Eddie murmured.
"Every word," Susanna echoed.
All three of them looked at Callahan, the old fella, the religious who would allow himself to be called pair but not priest. His twisted right hand went to the scar on his forehead and rubbed at it. At last he said,
"'Twas the drink. That's what I believe now. Not God, not devils. Not predestination, not the company of saints. 'Twas the drink."
He paused, thinking, then smiled at them. Roland remembered Nort, the weed-eater in Tull who had been brought back from the dead by the men in black. Nort had smiled like that.
"But if God made the world, then God made the drink. And that is also his will."
"Ka," Roland thought. Callahan sat quiet, rubbing the scarred crucifix on his forehead, gathering his thoughts. And then he began to tell his story. Chapter 3. The Priest's Tale, New York. 1. It was the drink. That was what he came to believe when he finally stopped it, and clarity came. Not God, not Satan, not some deep psychosexual battle between his blessed mither and his blessed da, just the drink. And was it surprising that whiskey should have taken him by the ears? He was Irish, he was a priest. One more strike and you're out. From seminary in Boston, he'd gone to a city parish in Lowell, Massachusetts. His parishioners had loved him. He wouldn't refer to them as his flock. Flocks were what you called seagulls on their way to the town dump. But after 7 years in Lowell, Callahan had grown uneasy. When talking to Bishop Dugan in the diocese office, he had used all the correct buzzwords of the time to express this unease. Anomie, urban malaise, an increasing lack of empathy, a sense of disconnection from the life of the spirit. He'd had a nip in the bathroom before his appointment, followed by a couple of wintergreen lifesavers, no fool he, and had been particularly eloquent that day. Eloquence does not always proceed from belief, but often proceeds from the bottle. And he was no liar. He had believed what he was saying that day in Dugan's study, every word. As he believed in Freud, the future of the mass spoken in English, the nobility of Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, and the idiocy of his widening war in Vietnam, waist-deep in the wide muddy, and the big fool said to push on, as the old folk tune had it. He believed in large part because those ideas, if they were ideas and not just cocktail party chatter, had been currently trading high on the intellectual big board. Social conscience is up 2 1/3, hearth and home down 1/4, but still your basic blue-chip stock. Later, it all became simpler. Later he came to understand that he wasn't drinking too much because he was spiritually unsettled, but spiritually unsettled because he was drinking too much. You wanted to protest, to say that couldn't be it, or not just that, it was too simple. But it was that. Just that. God's voice is still and small, the voice of a sparrow in a cyclone, so said the prophet Isaiah, and we all say thank you. It's hard to hear a small voice clearly if you're shit-ass drunk most of the time. Callahan left America for Roland's world before the computer revolution spawned the acronym GIGO, Garbage In, Garbage Out, but in plenty of time to hear someone at an AA meeting observe that if you put an asshole on a plane in San Francisco and flew him to the East Coast, the same asshole got off in Boston, usually with 4 or 5 drinks under his belt, but that was later. In 1964, he had believed what he believed, and plenty of people had been anxious to help him find his way. From Lowell, he had gone to Spofford, Ohio, a suburb of Dayton. There he stayed for 5 years, and then he began to feel restless again. Consequently, he began to talk the talk again. The kind the diocesan office listened to. The kind that got you moved on down the line. Anomy, spiritual disconnection, this time from his suburban parishioners. Yes, they liked him and he liked them, but something still seemed to be wrong. And there was something wrong, mostly in the quiet bar on the corner where everybody also liked him, and in the liquor cabinet in the rectory living room. Beyond small doses, alcohol is a toxin. And Callahan was poisoning himself on a nightly basis. It was the poison in his system, not the state of the world or that of his own soul, which was bringing him down. Had it always been that obvious? Later, at another AA meeting, he'd heard a guy refer to alcoholism and addiction as the elephant in the living room. How could you miss it? Callahan hadn't told him. He'd still been in the first 90 days of sobriety at that point, and that meant he was supposed to just sit there and be quiet. Take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth, the old-timers advised, and we all say thank you. But he could have told him, yes, indeed, you could miss the elephant if it was a magic elephant. If it had the power, like the shadow, to cloud men's minds. To actually make you believe that your problems were spiritual and mental, but absolutely not boozical. Good Christ, just the alcohol-related loss of the REM sleep was enough to screw you up righteously, but somehow you never thought of that while you were active. Booze turned your thought processes into something akin to that circus routine where all the clowns come piling out of the little car. When you looked back in sobriety, the things you'd said and done made you wince. I'd sit in a bar solving all the problems of the world, then not be able to find my car in the parking lot, one fellow at a meeting remembered, and we all say thank you. The things you thought were even worse. How could you spend the morning puking and the afternoon believing you were having a spiritual crisis? Yet he had. And his superiors had, possibly because more than a few of them were having their own problems with the magic elephant. Callahan began thinking that a smaller church, a rural parish, would put him back in touch with God and himself. And so, in the spring of 1969, he found himself in New England again. Northern New England this time. He had set up shop, bag and baggage, crucifix and chasuble, in the pleasant little town of Jerusalem's Lot, Maine. There, he had finally met real evil. Looked it in the face. And flinched. 2. A writer came to me, he said. A man named Ben Mears. I think I read one of his books, Eddie said. Air Dance, it was called, about a man who gets hung for the murder his brother committed. Callahan nodded. That's the one. There was also a teacher named Matthew Burke, and they both believed there was a vampire at work in Salem's Lot. The kind who makes other vampires. Is there any other kind? Eddie asked. Remembering about 100 movies of the Majestic and maybe 1,000 comic books purchased at and sometimes stolen from Dolly's. There is, and we'll get there, but never mind that now. Most of all, there was a boy who believed he was about the same age as your Jake. They didn't convince me, not at first, but they were convinced, and it was hard to stand against their belief. Also, something was going on in the lot, that much was certain. People were disappearing. There was an atmosphere of terror in the town. Impossible to describe it now, sitting here in the sun, but it was there. I had to officiate at the funeral of another boy. His name was Daniel Gleck. I doubt he was this vampire's first victim in the lot, and he certainly wasn't the last, but he was the first one who turned up dead. On the day of Danny Glick's burial, my life changed somehow. And I'm not talking about the quart of whiskey a day anymore, either. Something changed in my head. I felt it. Like a switch turning. And although I haven't had a drink in years, that switch is still turned. Susanna thought, that's when you went toe-dash, Father Callahan. Eddie thought, that's when you went 19, pal, or maybe it's 99, or maybe it's both somehow. Roland simply listened. His mind was clear of reflection, a perfect receiving machine. The writer Mears had fallen in love with a town girl named Susan Norton. The vampire took her. I believe he did it partly because he could, and partly to punish Mears for daring to form a group, a quartet, that would try to hunt him. We went to the place the vampire had bought, an old wreck called the Marston House. The thing staying there went by the name of Barlow.
Callahan sat, considering, looking through them and back to those old days. At last he resumed.
Barlow was gone, but he'd left the woman, and a letter. It was addressed to all of us, but was directed principally to me. The moment I saw her lying there in the cellar of the Marston House, I understood it was all true. The doctor with us listened to her chest and took her blood pressure, though, just to be sure. No heartbeat, blood pressure zero. But when Ben pounded the stake into her, she came alive. The blood flowed. She screamed over and over. Her hands, I remembered the shadows of her hands on the wall.
Eddie's hand gripped Susanna's. They listened in a horrified suspension that was neither belief nor disbelief. This wasn't a talking train powered by malfunctioning computer circuits, nor men and women who had reverted to savagery. This was something akin to the unseen demon that had come to the place where they had drawn Jake, or the doorkeeper in Dutch Hill.
"What did he say to you in his note, this Barlow?" Roland asked.
"That my faith was weak, and I would undo myself. He was right, of course. By then, the only thing I really believed in was Bushmills. I just didn't know it. He did, though. Booze is also a vampire, and maybe it takes one to know one.
The boy who was with us became convinced that this prince of vampires meant to kill his parents next, or turn them, for revenge. The boy had been taken prisoner, you see, but he escaped and killed the vampire's half-human accomplice, a man named Straker."
Roland nodded, thinking this boy sounded more and more like Jake. "What was his name?"
"Mark Petrie. I went with him to his house, and with all the considerable power my church affords, the cross, the stole, the holy water, and of course the Bible. But I had come to think of these things as symbols, and that was my Achilles' heel. Barlow was there. He had Petrie's parents, and then he had the boy. I held up my cross. It glowed. It hurt him. He screamed."
Callahan smiled, recalling that scream of agony. The look of it chilled Eddie's heart.
"I told him that if he hurt Mark, I'd destroy him, and at that moment I could have done it. He knew it, too. His response was that before I did, he'd rip the child's throat out. And he could have done it." "Mexican standoff," Eddie murmured, remembering a day by the Western Sea when he had faced Roland in a strikingly similar situation. "Mexican standoff, baby."
"What happened?" Susanna asked. Callahan's smile faded. He was rubbing his scarred right hand the way the gunslinger had rubbed his hip without seeming to realize it.
"The vampire made a proposal. He would let the boy go if I'd put down the crucifix I held. We'd face each other unarmed, his faith against mine. I agreed. God help me, I agreed. The boy..."
3. The boy is gone, like an eddy of dark water. Barlow seems to grow taller. His hair, swept back from his brow in the European manner, seems to float around his skull. He's wearing a dark suit and a bright red tie, impeccably knotted, and to Callahan, he seems part of the darkness that surrounds him. Mark Petrie's parents lie dead at his feet, their skulls crushed.
"Fulfill your part of the bargain, Shaman."
"But why should he? Why not drive him off, settle for a draw this night, or kill him outright? Something is wrong with the idea, terribly wrong, but he cannot pick out just what it is. Nor will any of the buzzwords that have helped him in previous moments of crisis be of any help to him here. This isn't anomie, lack of empathy, or the existential grief of the 20th century. This is a vampire, and his cross, which had been glowing fiercely, is growing dark. Fear leaps into his belly, like a confusion of hot wires. Barlow is walking toward him across the Petrie kitchen, and Callahan can see the thing's fangs very clearly because Barlow is smiling. It is a winner's smile. Callahan takes a step backward, then two, then his buttocks strike the edge of the table, and the table pushes back against the wall, and then there is nowhere left to go.
"Sad to see a man's faith fail," says Barlow, and reaches out.
Why should he not reach out? The cross Callahan is holding up is now dark. Now it's nothing but a piece of plaster, a cheap piece of rickrack his mother bought in a Dublin souvenir shop, probably at a scalper's price. The power it had sent ramming up his arm, enough spiritual voltage to smash down walls and shatter stone, is gone. Barlow plucks it from his fingers. Callahan cries out miserably, the cry of a child who suddenly realizes the boogeyman has been real all along, waiting patiently in the closet for its chance. And now comes a sound that will haunt him for the rest of his life. From New York and the secret highways of America to the AA meetings in Topeka, where he finally sobered up, to the final stop in Detroit, to his life here in Cala Bryn Sturgis. He will remember that sound when his forehead is scarred and he fully expects to be killed. He will remember it when he is killed. The sound is two dry snaps as Barlow breaks the arms of the cross, and the meaningless thump as he throws what remains on the floor. And he'll also remember the cosmically ludicrous thought which came even as Barlow reached for him. God, I need a drink. 4. The pair looked at Roland, Eddie, and Susanna with the eyes of one who is remembering the absolute worst moment of his life. You hear all sorts of sayings and slogans in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's one that recurs to me whenever I think of that night. Of Barlow taking hold of my shoulders. What? Eddie asked. Be careful what you pray for, Callahan said, because you just might get it. You got your drink, Roland said. Oh, yes, Callahan said. I got my drink. 5. Barlow's hands are strong, implacable. As Callahan is drawn forward, he suddenly understands what's going to happen. Not death. Death would be a mercy compared to this. No, please, no, he tries to say, but nothing comes out of his mouth but one small, whipped moan. Now, priest, the vampire whispers. Callahan's mouth is pressed against the reeking flesh of the vampire's cold throat. There is no enemy, no social dysfunction, no ethical or racial ramifications, only the stink of death and one vein, open and pulsing with Barlow's dead-infected blood. No sense of existential loss, no postmodern grief for the death of the American value system, not even the religio-psychological guilt of Western man. Only the effort to hold his breath forever, or twist his head away, or both. He cannot. He holds on for what seems like eons, smearing the blood across his cheeks and forehead and chin like war paint, to no avail. In the end, he does what all alcoholics must do once the booze has taken them by the ears. He drinks. Strike 3. You're out. 6. The boy got away. There was that much. And Barlow let me go. Killing me wouldn't have been any fun, would it? No. The fun was in letting me live. I wandered for an hour or more through a town that was less and less there. There aren't many type 1 vampires, and that's a blessing because a type 1 can cause one hell of a lot of mayhem in an extremely short period of time. The town was already half infected, but I was too blind, too shocked to realize it, and none of the new vampires approached me. Barlow had set his mark on me as surely as God set his mark on Cain before sending him off to dwell in the land of Nod. His watch and his warrant, as you'd say, Roland. There was a drinking fountain in the alley beside Spencer's Drugs, the sort of thing no public health office would have sanctioned a few years later, but back then there was one or two in every small town. I washed Barlow's blood off my face and neck there. Tried to wash it out of my hair, too. And then I went to St. Andrew's, my church. I'd made up my mind to pray for a second chance. Not to the God of the theologians who believe that everything holy and unholy ultimately comes from inside us, but to the old God, the one who proclaimed to Moses that he should not suffer a witch to live. and gave unto his own son the power to raise from the dead. A second chance is all I wanted. My life for that.
By the time I got to St. Andrew's, I was almost running. There were three doors going inside. I reached for the middle one. Somewhere a car backfired and someone laughed. I remember those sounds very clearly. It's as if they mark the border of my life as a priest of the Holy Roman Catholic Church.
What happened to you, Sugar? Susanna asked.
The door rejected me, Callahan said. It had an iron handle, and when I touched it, fire came out of it like a reverse stroke of lightning. It knocked me all the way down the steps and onto the cement path. It did this. He raised his scarred right hand.
And that? Eddie asked, and pointed to his forehead.
No, Callahan said. That came later. I picked myself up, walked some more, wound up at Spencer's again, only this time I went in, bought a bandage for my hand, and then, while I was paying, I saw the sign, Ride the Big Gray Dog.
He means greyhound, Sugar, Susanna told Roland. It's a nationwide bus company.
Roland nodded and twirled a finger in his go-on gesture.
Miss Coogan told me the next bus went to New York, so I bought a ticket on that one. If she'd told me it went to Jacksonville or Nome or Hot Burgoo, South Dakota, I would have gone to one of those places. All I wanted to do was get out of that town. I didn't care that people were dying and worse than dying, some of them my friends, some of them my parishioners. I just wanted to get out. Can you understand that?
Yes, Roland said with no hesitation. Very well.
Callahan looked into his face, and what he saw there seemed to reassure him a little. When he continued, he seemed calmer.
Loretta Coogan was one of the town spinsters. I must have frightened her because she said I'd have to wait for the bus outside. I went out. Eventually the bus came. I got on and gave the driver my ticket. He took his half and gave me my half. I sat down. The bus started to roll. We went under the flashing yellow blinker at the middle of town, and that was the first mile. The first mile on the road that took me here. Later on, maybe 4:30 in the morning, still dark outside, the bus stopped in...
7.
Hartford, the bus driver says. This is Hartford, Mac. We got a 20-minute rest stop. You want to go in and get a sandwich or something?
Callahan fumbles his wallet out of his pocket with his bandaged hand and almost drops it. The taste of death is in his mouth, a moronic, mealy taste like a spoiled apple. He needs something to take away that taste, and if nothing will take it away, something to change it. And if nothing will change it, at least something to cover it up, the way you might cover up an ugly gouge in a wood floor with a piece of cheap carpet. He holds out a 20 to the bus driver and says,
"Can you get me a bottle? Mister, the rules, and keep the change, of course. A pint would be fine. I don't need nobody cutting up on my bus. We'll be in New York in 2 hours. You can get anything you want once we're there."
The bus driver tries to smile.
"It's Fun City, you know."
Callahan, he's no longer Father Callahan, the flash of fire from the door handle answered that question at least, adds a 10 to the 20. Now he's holding out $30. Again, he tells the driver a pint would be fine, and he doesn't expect any change. This time, the driver, not an idiot, takes the money.
"But don't you go cutting up on me," he repeats. "I don't need nobody cutting up on my bus."
Callahan nods.
"No cutting up. That's a big 10-4.
The driver goes into the combination grocery store, liquor store, short order restaurant that exists here on the rim of Hartford, on the rim of morning, under yellow high-intensity lights. There are secret highways in America, highways in hiding. This place stands at one of the entrance ramps leading into that network of dark side roads, and Callahan senses it. It's in the way the Dixie cups and crumpled cigarette packs blow across the tarmac in the pre-dawn wind. It whispers from the sign on the gas pumps, the one that says, "Pay for gas in advance after sundown." It's in the teenage boy across the street, sitting on a porch stoop at 4:30 in the morning, with his head in his arms, a silent essay in pain. The secret highways are out close, and they whisper to him. "Come on, buddy," they say. Here is where you can forget everything, even the name they tied on you when you were nothing but a naked, blatting baby, still smeared with your mother's blood. They tied a name to you like a can to a dog's tail, didn't they? But you don't need to drag it around here. Come. Come on. But he goes nowhere. He's waiting for the bus driver, and pretty soon the bus driver comes back, and he's got a pint of Old Log Cabin in a brown paper sack. This is a brand Callahan knows well. A pint of the stuff probably goes for $2.25 out here in the boonies, which means the bus driver has just earned himself a $28 tip, give or take. Not bad. But it's the American way, isn't it? Give a lot to get a little. And if the log cabin will take that terrible taste out of his mouth, much worse than the throbbing in his burned hand, it'll be worth every penny of the $30. Hell, it would be worth a C-note. No cutting up, the driver says. I'll put you out right in the middle of the Cross Bronx Expressway if you start cutting up. I swear to God I will. By the time the Greyhound pulls into the Port Authority, Don Callahan is drunk. But he doesn't cut up. He simply sits quietly until it's time to get off and join the flow of 6 o'clock humanity under the cold fluorescent lights. The junkies, the cabbies, the shoeshine boys, the girls who'll blow you for $10, the boys dressed up as girls who'll blow you for $5, the cops twirling their nightsticks, the dope dealers carrying their transistor radios, the blue-collar guys who are just coming in from New Jersey. Callahan joins them, drunk, but quiet. The nightstick-twirling cops do not give him so much as a second glance. The Port Authority air smells of cigarette smoke and joysticks and exhaust. The docked buses rumble. Everyone here looks cut loose. Under the cold white fluorescence, they all look dead. No, he thinks, walking under a sign reading "To Street." Not dead, that's wrong. Undead. Eight. Man, Eddie said, you've been to the wars, haven't you? Greek, Roman, and Vietnam. When the old fellow began, Eddie had been hoping he'd gallop through his story so they could go into the church and look at whatever was stashed there. He hadn't expected to be touched, let alone shaken. But he had been. Callahan knew stuff Eddie thought no one else could possibly know. The sadness of Dixie cups rolling across the pavement, the rusty hopelessness of that sign on the gas pumps, the look of the human eye in the hour before dawn. Most of all, about how sometimes you had to have it. The wars? I don't know, Callahan said. Then he sighed and nodded. Yes, I suppose so. I spent that first day in movie theaters and that first night in Washington Square Park. I saw that the other homeless people covered themselves up with newspapers, so that's what I did. And here's an example of how life, the quality of life and the texture of life, seemed to have changed for me, beginning on the day of Danny Glick's burial. You won't understand right away, but bear with me. He looked at Eddie and smiled. And don't worry, son. I'm not going to talk the day away, or even the morning. You go on and tell it any old way it does you fine, Eddie said. Callahan burst out laughing. Say thank you. I say thank you big. What I was going to tell you is that I'd covered my top half with the Daily News, and the headline said, Hitler Brothers Strike in Queens. Oh, my God, the Hitler Brothers, Eddie said. I remember them, couple of morons. They beat up, what, Jews, blacks? Both, Callahan said, and carved swastikas on their foreheads. They didn't have a chance to finish mine, which is good because what they had in mind after the cutting was a lot more than a simple beating. And that was years later, when I came back to New York.
Swastika, Roland said. The sigil on the plane we found near River Crossing? The one with David Quick inside it?
Uh-huh, Eddie said, and drew one in the grass with the toe of his boot. The grass sprang up almost immediately, but not before Roland saw that, yes, the mark on Callahan's forehead could have been meant to be one of those.
if it had been finished. On that day, in late October of 1975, Callahan said, the Hitler brothers were just a headline I slept under. I spent most of that second day in New York walking around and fighting the urge to score a bottle. There was part of me that wanted to fight instead of drink, to try and atone. At the same time, I could feel Barlow's blood working into me, getting in deeper and deeper. The world smelled different and not better. Things looked different and not better, and the taste of him came creeping back into my mouth, a taste like dead fish or rotten wine. I had no hope of salvation. Never think it, but atonement isn't about salvation anyway, not about heaven. It's about clearing your conscience here on earth. And you can't do it drunk. I didn't think of myself as an alcoholic, not even then, but I did wonder if he'd turned me into a vampire. If the sun would start to burn my skin, and I'd start looking at ladies' necks. He shrugged, laughed. Or maybe gentlemen's. You know what they say about the priesthood. We're just a bunch of closet queers running around and shaking the cross in people's faces. But you weren't a vampire, Eddie said. Not even a type three. Nothing but unclean. On the outside of everything, cast away. Always smelling his stink, and always seeing the world the way things like him must see it, in shades of grey and red. Red was the only bright colour I was allowed to see for years. Everything else was just a whisper. I guess I was looking for a manpower office, you know, the day labour company. I was still pretty rugged in those days, and of course I was a lot younger as well. I didn't find manpower. What I did find was a place called Home. This was on First Avenue and 47th Street, not far from the UN.
Roland, Eddie, and Susanna exchanged a look. Whatever Home was, it had existed only two blocks from the vacant lot. Only it wouldn't have been vacant back then, Eddie thought. Not back in 1975. In 75, it would still have been Tom and Jerry's artistic deli, party platters our specialty. He suddenly wished Jake were here. Eddie thought that by now the kid would have been jumping up and down with excitement. What kind of shop was Home? Roland asked.
Not a shop at all. A shelter. A wet shelter. I can't say for sure that it was the only one in Manhattan, but I bet it was one of the very few. I didn't know much about shelters then, just a little bit from my first parish, but as time went by, I learned a great deal. I saw the system from both sides. There were times when I was the guy who ladled out the soup at 6 p.m. and passed out the blankets at 9. At other times, I was the guy who drank the soup and slept under the blankets. After a head check for lice, of course. There are shelters that won't let you in if they smell booze on your breath. And there are ones where they'll let you in if you claim you're at least 2 hours downstream from your last drink. There are places, a few, that'll let you in pissy-ass drunk, as long as they can search you at the door and get rid of all your hooch. Once that's taken care of, they put you in a special locked room with the rest of the low-bottom guys. You can't slip out to get another drink if you change your mind, and you can't scare the folks who are less soaked than you are if you get the DTs and start seeing bugs come out of the walls. No women allowed in the lockup. They're too apt to get raped. It's just one of the reasons more homeless women die in the streets than homeless men. That's what Lupe used to say.
Lupe? Eddie asked.
I'll get to him, but for now, suffice it to say that he was the architect of Home's alcohol policy. At Home, they kept the booze in lockup, not the drunks. You could get a shot if you needed one, and if you promised to be quiet. Plus a sedative chaser. This isn't recommended medical procedure. I'm not even sure it was legal, since neither Lupe nor Rowan Magruder were doctors, but it seemed to work. I came in sober on a busy night, and Lupe put me to work. I worked free for the first couple of days, and then Rowan called me into his office, which was roughly the size of a broom closet. He asked me if I was an alcoholic. I said no. He asked me if I was wanted by the police. I said no. He asked if I was on the run from anything. I said yes. From myself. He asked me if I wanted to work, and I started to cry. He took that as a yes. I spent the next 9 months, until June of 1976, working at Home. I made the beds, I cooked in the kitchen,
I went on fundraising calls with Lupe or sometimes Rowan. I took drunks to AA meetings in a home van. I gave shots of booze to guys that were shaking too badly to hold the glasses themselves. I took over the books because I was better at it than Magruder or Lupe or any of the other guys who worked there. Those weren't the happiest days of my life. I'd never go that far. And the taste of Barlow's blood never left my mouth, but they were days of grace. I didn't think a lot. I just kept my head down and did whatever I was asked to do. I started to heal. Sometime during that winter, I realized that I'd started to change. It was as if I developed a kind of sixth sense. Sometimes I heard chiming bells, horrible yet at the same time sweet. Sometimes, when I was on the street, things would start to look dark even if the sun was shining. I can remember looking down to see if my shadow was still there. I'd be positive it wouldn't be, but it always was. Roland's quartet exchanged a glance. Sometimes there was an olfactory element to these fugues. It was a bitter smell, like strong onions all mixed with hot metal. I began to suspect that I had developed a form of epilepsy.
Did you see a doctor? Susanna asked.
I did not. I was afraid of what else he might find. A brain tumor seemed most likely. What I did was keep my head down and keep working. And then one night, I went to a movie in Times Square. It was a revival of two Clint Eastwood westerns, what they used to call spaghetti westerns.
Yeah, Eddie said.
I started hearing the bells, the chimes, and smelling that smell stronger than ever. All this was coming from in front of me, and to the left, I looked there and saw two men, one rather elderly, the other younger. They were easy enough to pick out because the place was three quarters empty. The younger man leaned close to the older man. The older man never took his eyes off the screen, but he put his arm around the younger man's shoulders. If I'd seen that on any other night, I would have been pretty positive what was going on, but not that night. I watched, and I started to see a kind of dark blue light. First, just around the younger man, then around both of them. It was like no other light I'd ever seen. It was like the darkness I felt sometimes on the street when the chimes started to play in my head, like the smell. You knew those things weren't there, and yet they were. And I understood. I didn't accept it. That came later, but I understood. The younger man was a vampire.
He stopped, thinking about how to tell his tale, how to lay it out.
I believe there are at least three types of vampires at work in our world. I call them types 1, 2, and 3. Type 1s are rare. Barlow was a type 1. They live very long lives and may spend extended periods, 50 years, 100, maybe 200, in deep hibernation. When they're active, they're capable of making new vampires, what we call the undead. These undead are type 2s. They are also capable of making new vampires, but they aren't cunning.
He looked at Eddie and Susanna. Have you seen Night of the Living Dead? Susanna shook her head. Eddie nodded.
The undead in that movie were zombies, utterly brain dead. Type 2 vampires are more intelligent than that, but not much. They can't go out during the daylight hours. If they try, they are blinded, badly burned, or killed. Although I can't say for sure, I believe their lifespans are usually short. Not because the change from living and human to undead and vampire shortens life, but because the existences of type 2 vampires are extremely perilous. In most cases, this is what I believe, not what I know, type 2 vampires create other type 2 vampires in a relatively small area. By this phase of the disease, and it is a disease, the type 1 vampire, the king vampire, has usually moved on. In Salem's Lot, they actually killed the son of a bitch, one of what might have been only a dozen in the entire world. In other cases, type 2s create type 3s. Type 3s are like mosquitoes. They can't create more vampires, but they can feed and feed and feed.
Do they catch AIDS? Eddie asked. I mean, you know what that is, right?
I know. Although I never heard the term until the spring of 1983, when I was working at the Lighthouse Shelter in Detroit, and my time in America had grown short.
Of course, we'd known for almost 10 years that there was something. Some of the literature called it GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. In 1982, there started to be newspaper articles about a new disease called gay cancer and speculations that it might be catching. On the street, some of the men called it fucksore disease, after the blemishes it left. I don't believe that vampires die of it or even get sick from it, but they can have it, and they can pass it on. Oh, yes, and I have reason to think that.
Callahan's lips quivered, then firmed.
When this vampire demon made you drink his blood, he gave you the ability to see these things, Roland said.
Yes.
All of them, or just the threes? The little ones?
The little ones, Callahan mused, then voiced a brief and humorless laugh. Yes, I like that. In any case, threes are all I've ever seen, at least since leaving Jerusalem's lot. But of course, type ones like Barlow are very rare, and type twos don't last long. Their very hunger undoes them. They're always ravenous. Type threes, however, can go out in daylight, and they take their principal sustenance from food, just as we do.
What did you do that night? Susanna asked. In the theater.
Nothing, Callahan said. My whole time in New York, my first time in New York, I did nothing until April. I wasn't sure, you see. I mean, my heart was sure, but my head refused to go along, and all the time, there was interference from the most simple thing of all. I was a dry alcoholic. An alcoholic is also a vampire, and that part of me was getting thirstier and thirstier, while the rest of me was trying to deny my essential nature. So I told myself I'd seen a couple of homosexuals canoodling in the movies, nothing more than that. As for the rest of it, the chimes, the smell, the dark blue light around the young one, I convinced myself it was epilepsy, or a holdover from what Barlow had done to me, or both. And of course about Barlow I was right. His blood was awake inside me. It saw.
It was more than that, Roland said.
Callahan turned to him.
You went toe-dash, Pear. Something was calling you from this world, the thing in your church, I suspect, although it would not have been in your church when you first knew of it.
No,
Callahan said.
He was regarding Roland with wary respect.
It was not. How do you know? Tell me, I beg.
Roland did not. Go on, he said. What happened to you next?
Lupe happened next, Callahan said.
9. His last name was Delgado. Roland registered only a moment of surprise at this, a widening of the eyes. But Eddie and Susanna knew the gunslinger well enough to understand that even this was extraordinary. At the same time, they had become almost used to these coincidences that could not possibly be coincidences, to the feeling that each one was the click of some great turning cog. Lupe Delgado was 32. An alcoholic almost 5 one-day-at-a-time years from his last drink, and had been working at home since 1974. Magruder had founded the place, but it was Lupe Delgado who invested it with real life and purpose. During his days, he was part of the maintenance crew at the Plaza Hotel on Fifth Avenue. Nights, he worked at the shelter. He had helped to craft Holmes' wet policy and had been the first person to greet Callahan when he walked in.
I was in New York a little over a year that first time, Callahan said. But by March of 1976, I had...
He paused, struggling to say what all three of them understood from the look on his face. His skin had flushed rosy except for where the scar lay. That seemed to glow an almost preternatural white by comparison.
Oh, okay, I suppose you'd say that by March I'd fallen in love with him. Does that make me a queer? A faggot? I don't know. They say we all are, don't they? Some do anyway, and why not? Every month or two there seemed to be another story in the paper about a priest with a penchant for sticking his hand up the altar boy's skirts. As for myself, I had no reason to think of myself as queer. God knows I wasn't immune to the turn of a pretty female leg, priest or not, and molesting the altar boys never crossed my mind. Nor was there ever anything physical between Lupe and me. But I loved him.
And I'm not just talking about his mind or his dedication or his ambitions for home, not just because he'd chosen to do his real work among the poor like Christ, either. There was a physical attraction.
Callahan paused, struggled, then burst out,
God, he was beautiful. Beautiful.
What happened to him? Roland asked.
He came in one snowy night in late March. The place was full, and the natives were restless. There had already been one fistfight, and we were still picking up from that. There was a guy with a full-blown fit of the DTs, and Rowan Magruder had him in back in his office, feeding him coffee laced with whiskey. As I think I told you, we had no lock-up room at home. It was dinner time, half an hour past, actually, and three of the volunteers hadn't come in because of the weather. The radio was on, and a couple of women were dancing. Feeding time in the zoo, Lupe used to say. I was taking off my coat, heading for the kitchen. This fellow named Frank Spinelli collared me, wanted to know about a letter of recommendation I'd promised to write him. There was a woman, Lisa somebody, who wanted help with one of the AA steps, made a list of those we had harmed. There was a young guy who wanted help with a job application. He could read a little but not write. Something starting to burn on the stove, complete confusion. And I liked it. It had a way of sweeping you up and carrying you along. But in the middle of it all, I stopped. There were no bells, and the only aromas were drunks, B.O., and burning food. But that light was around Lupe's neck, like a collar. And I could see marks there, just little ones. No more than nips, really. I stopped, and I must have reeled, because Lupe came hurrying over, and then I could smell it. Just faintly. Strong onions and hot metal. I must have lost a few seconds, too, because all at once the two of us were in the corner by the filing cabinet where we keep the AA stuff, and he was asking me when I last ate. He knew I sometimes forgot to do that. The smell was gone. The blue glow around his neck was gone, and those little nips, where something had bitten him, they were gone, too. Unless the vampire's a real guzzler, the marks go in a hurry. But I knew. It was no good asking him who he'd been with, or when, or where. Vampires, even type threes, especially type threes, maybe, have their protective devices. Pond leeches secrete an enzyme in their saliva that keeps the blood flowing while they're feeding. It also numbs the skin, so unless you actually see the thing on you, you don't know what's happening. With these type 3 vampires, it's as if they carry a kind of selective, short-term amnesia in their saliva. I passed it off somehow, told him I'd just felt lightheaded for a second or two, blamed it on coming out of the cold and into all the noise and light and heat. He accepted it, but told me I had to take it easy. "You're too valuable to lose, Don," he said, and then he kissed me. "Here."
Callahan touched his right cheek with his scarred right hand.
So I guess I lied when I said there was nothing physical between us, didn't I? There was that one kiss. I can still remember exactly how it felt. Even the little prickle of fine stubble on his upper lip. Here.
I am so very sorry for you, Susanna said.
Thank you, my dear, he said. I wonder if you know how much that means. How wonderful it is. To have condolence from one's own world. It's like being a castaway and getting news from home or fresh water from a spring after years of stale bottled stuff.
He reached out, took her hand in both of his, and smiled. To Eddie, something in that smile looked forced or even false. And he had a sudden, ghastly idea. What if Pear Callahan was smelling a mixture of bitter onions and hot metal right now? What if he was seeing a blue glow not around Susanna's neck like a collar, but around her stomach, like a belt? Eddie looked at Roland, but there was no help there. The gunslinger's face was expressionless.
He had AIDS, didn't he? Eddie asked. Some gay type 3 vampire bit your friend and passed it on to him.
Gay, Callahan said. Do you mean to tell me that stupid word actually?
He trailed off, shaking his head.
Yep, Eddie said. The Red Sox still haven't won the series, and homos are gays.
Eddie, Susanna said.
Hey, Eddie said. Do you think it's easy being the one who left New York last and forgot to turn off the lights? 'Cause it's not, and let me tell you, I'm feeling increasingly out of date myself.
He turned back to Callahan.
Anyway, that is what happened, isn't it?
I think so. You have to remember that I didn't know a great deal myself at that time, and was denying and repressing what I did know, with great vigor, as President Kennedy used to say.